here in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Matt Dillmore, along with Mr. Mark Cohen. Mark, thank you so much for inviting me to your home slash studio and pulling up just kind of first blush. There's an amazing sculpture in your front yard right by the street. Would you care to give the listeners some info on that beautiful sculpture?
That was made by my son Isaac, and he made it about 10 or 15 years ago in New York, where he works now. And it was like an early attempt to begin to make this monumental sculpture. I think he, you know, saw some Sarah pieces, and he thought that he would be able to do the same thing, you know, and he still thinks that, and he has a big studio up in Scranton, but doesn't use it too much.
When you see a Cartier-Bresson photograph, how did a young kid growing up and finding himself in Wilkes-Barre, how did he come to know folks like Cartier-Bresson or an Ansel Adams or a Diane Arbus?
Well, when I started to take pictures, someone gave me a camera, and I very quickly started to, I had an uncle, I mean, I lived in a family. It was before, you know, families became atomized, you know, and I had an uncle that had an enlarger, and I had a cousin that had a darkroom, and they would show me how to do things, and I was, you know, like 12 and 13 years old, and 14, and I learned to develop film, and my shop teacher helped me. And gradually I got to the Eastman Kodak High School Photo Contest when I was like 15, like, you know, in high school. And I won one, or I got second prize. And then I entered again, and I got third prize. And at this time, I was also in camera clubs. Camera clubs at this is like in 1957, 59-ish. You know? So I'd go to camera clubs, and I'd meet a lot of these old guys, and they'd have print nights, and they would have, you know, we would exhibit the pictures, and I learned how to print better and better by myself. And somehow I saw the decisive moment, the actual book. Mm-hmm. And then soon after that, I went to Penn State. I got a Leica M3 when I was still in high school, which was, you know, it's very important to have good stuff, good equipment to work with when you're beginning. Then I was at Penn State. I took some terrific courses in art history at Penn State and understood who the Nabi was. And, you know, I understand how Guernica worked. And then I, you know, looked at Cartier-Bresson some more. So I began to see that I could be an artist and a photographer. And I saw Robert Frank and William Klein, and I was doing it too. But I exhibited in New York as soon as I could drive. You know, I had like an exhibit at a place called the Spanish National Tourist Office when I was about 20 or 22. I went to Spain, you know. I was really into Cartier-Bresson, you know. So I went to Spain and made pictures there. And then I took them and I got them exhibited at this tourist office in New York. So the idea of going to New York was with me, you know, has always been part of my thinking.
Do people know that you're still here in Wilkes-Barre? I mean, you're
my dealer knows.
that's true.
The gallery knows, or, you know, but I think they lost a phone number sometime. I'm not sure they have that, you know.
But it's really interesting that kind of in at that time, you can start in, say, the mid or late 50s, taking photographs for the first time, and suddenly 10, 15 years later, I mean, you're a renowned photographer and having these shows and really kind of changing the landscape of how people view photography here in the United States and abroad. Is it, when you look back, do you go, wow, I covered a hell of a lot of ground in a relatively short amount of time?
I've been all through photography in New York. I quit like six galleries in New York, but really, in some ways, I was instrumental in moving the price of pictures up. Because at Light Gallery, when my pictures were $150 and Harry Callahan's were $350, one day I went to Rochester and I sold like 20 pictures for $150. So I called the gallery and I said, raise my price to $350. And they said, well, we can't because we have to raise everybody's prices. And that actually happened. So Harry Callahan, all the prices went up at that time. And I really had some part of that. You know what I mean? happened in Washington. There was a guy, Harry Lunn, in Washington that had a gallery, and Harold Jones. And I was in the middle of the whole photo thing for a long time. But I always lived in Wilkes-Barre. I went to New York 3 or 4 hours at a time, you know.
For listeners who may not know the kind of Mark Cohen mystique, I recommend, I think a good jumping off point is Grimm Street. Talk to me about those photographs. It's black and white, an exclusively black and white endeavor. Where did those photographs, how did they emerge? And talk a little bit about your process in capturing these images.
Well, most of the pictures in Grimm Street are, I guess the heart of Grimm Street is like the 70s, 73, 74, 75, in around there, with some at both ends, before and after. And most of them were made in Wilkes-Barre. And I would go out and take pictures in Wilkes-Barre and shoot 2 or 3 rolls of film each time I went out. And a lot of the pictures were pictures of people on the street or things on the street or all different kinds of things. And then I started to integrate flash with it. But these pictures were made, and they were dry, and they were exhibited in New York with 60 days later. I was have a show in Light Gallery. And at that time, photography was much different. Now there might be 200 photography galleries in New York. Then there were only like, 6 or 7, I don't know how many. So I had good reviews in the New York Times, and they would run pictures of, so the kind of pictures I took where I would cut somebody's head off or just take a picture of somebody's leg or their elbow, it became like a part of the visual language at the time. But I was never really around, The whole Cedar Bar aspect of abstract expressionism didn't exist for me. There wasn't any, there weren't any colleagues or anything. I was like isolated out here. I was running this studio. I had 2 kids. And I had this whole other life that I did, except for the short time I was in New York. And then those pictures became Grimm Street. But it took me 20 years to actually get it published, to see the way to get it published. Bruce Silverstein, introduced me to these guys at Powerhouse Books. And then that's how that book evolved.
Is it a daunting task, or is it fun to go through, say, 20 years of photos and try to? It's got to be a different thing to put a book together as opposed to put together a show.
Well, I made a dummy for the book 20 years before I even showed the book to anybody. I just thought people would be calling me up. I thought it would be like, it was such an obvious thing for a publisher to do, and publishers did call me up, but it didn't work for me some way. There was something that prevented me in some way from actually publishing the book in 20 years earlier. So the heart of the book was made 20 years before I published it. And then I made 200 11 by 14 glossies for the dummy, and I kept them in a box for a couple of years. And then finally I went to New York, and I cut them in half, and I think I made a good cut, but I could make another book the same as Grimm Street from the other 200 pictures. And that's only 200 because I've made thousands of pictures.
You mentioned earlier in the interview cutting off people's heads, maybe going in really tight on hands or a paracord in the middle of the street. How did that emerge for you? Like, what is the actual nuts and bolts of how do you approach people? Because I know how you work, but I feel like the listeners will find it interesting how you kind of just roll up on people and kind of attack your subjects, but in a way that has a definite point of view.
Well, there would always be some sort of visual triggering aspect of the scene, like a button or a hand or a tattoo or a wisp of hair or some kind of something that I would see that would be, the part of the picture that the world circulated around. And I would get very close to these things. Like you mentioned the paracord on the street. And that picture, it's hard because we're on a radio here, but if the listener doesn't see the picture, but there's a column, there's a degrading column that's dissolving away by the paracord, And I understood this idea of taking pictures of thrown away food. I have hundreds of pictures like that. And I thought it was like, I knew the name Samuel Beckett. I knew the name of certain French phenomenologists, sure. but I didn't really understand what it was about, you know, except it was like neat to look at. I have a picture of a bottle with a plastic bag in the wind in the yes. book, you know. And so there are certain things that are sort of like this unconsciously derived phenomena that I would see on the street. And because it was on the street and because it was an accident, I would get down. I wouldn't even look through the camera. I would just put the camera down close to it and make a picture or make two pictures and look at those negatives. Most of the time, I just took one. I said, well, I fool around with it. You know, I just make a picture of a pear on the street and it would be finished.
And would you at the end of your day, would you come back here initially and boom, yeah. develop those?
Yeah. I would develop the film and then I'd make 8 or 9 prints of the negatives, and then like 6 months later, I'd make the contacts. I work right from the negative. I'd dry the film and cut up like I'd have 18 strips of 6 and a magnifying glass, and the trays all set up, and I would go through and I would make these prints. And maybe in 1974, I must have made like 1,000 of them or something like that. You know, 16 by 20s, yeah. always exactly the same size. I had this metal mask that I used so that there was no fooling around with format or anything.
You mentioned Samuel Beckett. There's traces of other artists' work in your work. Yours is kind of unto its own, but also influenced by, say, Flannery O'Connor or a Fellini, for example, people that work in different realms. How do those artists, do you see that stuff kind of creep into your work? And for example, Joel Peter Witkin writes the introduction to Grimm Street, not necessarily the go-to guy for a street photographer's collection of work. That's what part of the allure of the work is. I feel that it crosses kind of a wide range of artists and disciplines. How do these people influence your work, if they do at all?
Well, you mentioned a long range of pictures.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You go from Joel Peter Witkin to Beckett, you know what I mean? And they're vastly different sensibilities, you know. Witkin works in a studio or a morgue or however he works, you know. And I don't do anything like that, you know. But I think that, you know, he has seen my work, you know. And I think...
I mean, you can see where for example, pictures of a shot in True Color, the kind of impromptu beach where they're laying on the newspaper towels.
Yeah.
But it's of the torso. You yeah. could see how somebody like Witkin would go, ah, I get that. I get what he's doing here.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of pictures of torsos and arms and limbs, you know, in the same, you know, I have one that I took at the British Museum of one of the Elgin marbles, you know, it's not in these books, you know, but I did it only as like, you know, always reaching back toward this classical kind of thing. I didn't, you know, when I take pictures today, I try to find little pieces of towns around here that haven't changed in 50 years so that the pictures can be this uniform body of work where you don't see any. I never go to the mall to take pictures right. because the backgrounds are all wrong. Right. You know, the people might be okay. So I have to find like little pieces of small towns nearby where there's some old stores lined up and somebody's going to walk by and I can make a picture that looks like 1975, but I make it in 2012.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of segue into part of my next question, which is people that first kind of came to your work in the 70s when it was praised for its kind of startling quality. Do you find now that with the publication of these books, coupling that with, say, the advent of digital photography and the popularity of even iPhone cameras and stuff like that, do you feel that just by virtue of the fact that there are more people doing street photography, that you're gaining a legion of new fans, and if so, does that kind of, is that tough to wrestle with, or kind of?
It hasn't reached me yet.
Really?
No, it really hasn't. You know what I mean? I haven't. It's like I'm like, there are certain people that know about this work, but not nearly as many as that know about Sally Mann.
Right.
And you know, Sally Mann's practically a fraud as far as I can see. You know. And there's some things that are so facile in so many photographers' work. You know, I don't want to, you know, get involved with that. But my work, I think, I look in the New York Times and I see pictures of, you know, that of guys that are taking pictures for the newspaper that will cut heads off now all the time, and you would never see that in 1970. So it's almost like a commonality to you know, truncate things and do wide angle close ups and things like that that I think people saw that I did that were shocking in the early 70s, you know.
And specifically, if we can, with respect to Grimm Street, you working in black and white, what kind of mojo did black and white give you at that time?
The mojo was the speed that I could work. I could walk right by somebody and take a picture. And I would have my camera set at f22, and I'd have a little flash in one hand and the Tri-X in the camera, and I could just have the 28 millimeter lens set out at, you know, 20 inches, and I didn't have to focus or anything. I would just like go by somebody, no conversations, just walk right by and take a picture of somebody. Well, you can't do that today. It's a different time today. I finished doing that. I'm doing different pictures with a 50 millimeter lens now, but sometimes they look very similar. So that was exciting to do that on the street, and then to stand here and look at the negatives, you know, because once I'm making negatives, basically, you know, I had this dye transfer portfolio printed out in Seattle, and it's so wonderful that I realized that, you know, like, I don't print so hot, but I print like Ouija, you know what I mean? This is like the trunk of a car here, you know what I mean? But I make a pretty good print, you know, and people buy them sometimes, you know.
Well, it's got to be a different thing where if a woman in a kerchief is coming out of a department store and you snap a photo of her, if there's a kid, say, in an alleyway, and suddenly it's just you and the kid, and then the boy's father happens to pass through that alleyway and say, hey, what's this?
Right.
What's this guy doing?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a very, you know, it looks very suspicious. It looks suspicious. If I take a picture, I take a lot of pictures from out of my car, you know, with the window down. And I actually take a picture of a subject. I'm not not the mirror, like Mr. Friedlander. You know, I try to actually make a picture, you know. But that looks bad too. You know what I mean? You want to take pictures today, you got to take a picture of the river or something that makes sense to an observer. But when you're walking in an alley taking a picture, I have this picture that I made, which is, it's a great story, but if you don't see the picture, it's not such a hot story. But I was in between two tall walls in Scranton, and a woman came walking down the alley, and I'm come up, and I set the camera to take a picture. And at the time I'm setting the camera to take a picture, she's getting a razor ready to cut me in case I give her any trouble. And I didn't see it till I developed the film. Then I saw the film, you know, and you see the picture, and it's like, it's amazing, you know, that you can see this frightened woman. Because we're between, it's daylight, these two tall walls. You know, there's a certain phenomenology about being between walls that are different than being on a plane. And it was shadowed and it was sort of frightening. So it was an interesting thing to see that negative, you know.
You talk about alleyways. The flash against the snowflakes falling in Grimm Street, that shot, one of my favorites. And also, the stuff that you do with insects, there's the wasp against the wheel well of an automobile. How much of that is, oh my God, it's raining, I got to get somewhere in Wilkes-Barre, or it's snowing, I got to get to this alleyway? How much of it was, I've lived here, I know the people, I know how the light's going to strike this alleyway when it's raining as opposed to sun shining, and getting out there and making your own opportunities like that?
Well, the insect opportunities are always there when it's warm, when the sun is out. And, you know, I'd always love to take pictures of insects with the normal lens, you know, not in the national, you know, not in the scientific sense, but like in the, you know, the regular macro sense. So I'm just, the snow, I have hundreds and hundreds of pictures of snow, you know what I mean? Or if it was raining, you know, I would have a need to take pictures. So I said, well, I'll go under a bridge, you know, and I'll go out and take pictures now, you know, and I'll do this, shoot a roll, you know, and keep this process going and keep making these pictures. So I'd go to some place where there was a, a bridge. I parked a car under the bridge, and there would be some kids hanging around or something would be going on. I'd walk out into the rain and make pictures. There was some graffiti or something that I used at that time. So that I could, I could do that.
With a bit of a transition into true color, how did you in your kind of own head as an artist, how did you make that transition from black and white to color? Or was there overlap that I'm just not aware of at kind of concurrently?
Well, I was running a photography studio, and at a certain time Kodak came out with a 400 speed color negative film. And I had a color lab that did all my portrait work, and I started to fool around with this film a little bit. It was pretty expensive to get prints made. So I made a few, and then I ran into Bill Jenkins at the George Eastman house, and we did a little project where he made 100 color prints for me and 100 color prints for them. It was a deal, you know what I mean? And they processed all this film, and then I was able to work in exactly the same way with color as I worked with black and white. But I want, you should understand now that in the total body of work, color is 5% or 4% of it. I just happened to have made this terrific color portfolio that Rose Gallery made. So it was when there became a 400 speed color film that I tried to do some work on the street with color film.
Like you say, a lot of these photographs were taken over the course of, say, that summertime, 75, 76, 77. What are your memories of putting together that what would ultimately become True Color?
I don't know. I can't answer that question. I don't have any memories of that. I the idea of the 400 speed color film, and it, half of the pictures in True Color could work as black and white. It's like the same kind of intrusion. It's the same kind of thing. But I have I have this one terrific picture of a red wall. There's just this red wall, and it's like an in-focus Rothko or something. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, so there are certain things that are extreme color pictures, and there are other things that are just the same as Grimm Street pictures, and they're all mixed together, And then Eastman House made this thing, and then I started printing myself. I took a year. Fuji came out with a 1600 speed film. So now I could take pictures without, I didn't need a flash. And so I fooled around with that for a year. In 1987, I did almost a whole year of 1600 speed Fuji color. And I used to buy it at drugstores, which I thought was pretty, instead of buying like a professional 20 rolls, I'd run out of film and I'd have to find a drugstore, because you could still buy film in any drugstore. And it was like sort of like this way of working where I needed to get into a drugstore to get another roll of film to continue my work. And then I take it to the 1 hour place, have the negatives made. And then by that time, I was printing my own color pictures once. I want to see how you do color.
With True Color, how do you respond to folks that say, this is a little kind of cheerier? There's a bit maybe less of the grittiness that was in the collection that was Grimm Street.
I don't know. Maybe it's because the True Color book got put together in 10 minutes at a cocktail party in New York. I mean, it was like these guys said, well, the guy, Powerhouse said, well, we'll do a color book. And I went in the dark room and printed it. And then then I had to print like a bunch of 8x10 reproduction prints. And so I went through negatives and I picked it out and made the things. And then when Rose Gallery made this portfolio of dyes, then I started look at the negatives a little more closely, and we selected 30 negatives that in conjunction with other people. So it wasn't the same as these two books. I just made them myself. And now I want to make a third book, but now I'll do it, with more thought maybe, But I'm very happy with these two.
Oh, for sure, for sure. One of the photographs that kind of is when you think of Mark Cohen, your mind goes to a few in particular. One is the cover of Grimm Street with the girl in an alleyway jump roping. I'm curious to find out a bit more about that photograph. But one of my favorites is the Headless Horseman photograph. And I was wondering if you could kind of give us a bit of insight into how you took that famous shot?
I was in a place north of Scranton, and at that time, when I started making those pictures, I was using a 21 millimeter lens, so I was even closer. And I watched these guys, you know, and they would get all dressed up and ride horses and do this English fox hunting thing, but they did it just a little bit north of Scranton, Dalton, PA. And I was just standing around. I wasn't on a horse or anything. I was just taking pictures of them as they got ready to go. And I, you know, it's 1967. I'm talking about a negative I made like 40, 50 years ago, so I guess. And when the one guy touched the other guy's hand, I just was right close to it, and I made the picture. And one of the things I learned to do when I was using a 21 was keep the camera level, because if you tip a camera when it's on a wide-angle lens, you get all these distortion things, and they don't look good. So I learned to do that, and I cut their heads off. You know, I mean, their heads were cut. The picture is about the hands touching, and then the horses are in it and everything. And then that's how I made that picture. I can't remember the contact sheet, but many of these pictures are just one frame, mm-hmm. you know.
And the girl with jump rope, I'm interested to find out the backstory about that, and also why it's the cover photo.
Well, it's a cover photo because it's a real strong picture, and it's not the bubblegum, which everybody sees the bubblegum picture. But the and there's not a backstory. It's a, this is made in an alley in Wilkes-Barre. It's like a quarter of a mile from here, or half a mile from here where we're sitting. And I used to go up there all the time and take pictures and walk through several blocks, and it was like a set for me. And I would go up, and there would be activity, especially in the summer, and especially in the evening. And it was nicer to use a flash in the evening because you can balance the flashlight and the ambient light and make these pictures have, you know, this presence. You see the shadow of the girl on the ground and the shadow of the rope, and the rope goes between her knees, you know, and in the picture, and her head's cut off, and then there's these three buttons on the bottom. I mean, it's an absolutely fantastic picture to have made by accident. It's a chance. I didn't look through the lens when I took this picture. I just held the camera up, and she was posing for me, and I just took a picture, and it worked, you know. And I have a bunch that worked like that because I was doing it 4 days a week or 5 days a week. You know, I was just loving to do it because it's very stimulating to work when you've got a gallery in New York that will show the work as soon as you bring it in. You know what I mean? And I had a show at the Museum of Modern Art when I was like 30 or so, 33, I think. You know what I mean? And that's a, you know, when you're recognized in the same time you're working, it puts you on a very strong platform to work. You know what I mean? It really does that.
At that time, we obviously didn't have the internet, and kind of information wasn't as readily accessible in some respects. But 33 years of age, show at the Museum of Modern Art, does that get back to the folks here in Wilkes-Barre? Did that stuff kind of travel through the grapevine, and did that affect then your persona when you would go out and take photographs?
No, not at all. I mean, certain people knew that it was pretty good to have that show. I mean, but when I would go out and take pictures, it had nothing whatever to do with the pictures I was making. It had nothing to do with the wedding photography I was doing or anything like that. You know, I mean, it was like that was something that was a New York thing.
Talk to me a little bit. It touches in some of the interviews that are included in the True Color and Grimm Street books. You mentioned, you kind of allude to travels to Mexico City in particular. Tell me what the allure is of Mexico City, and if those photos will ever be anthologized in any way.
Well, the first trip I took to Mexico City really knocked me out. I mean, it was an amazing thrill for me, you know, to go the first time I went. And I spoke a little Spanish, and I knew, you know, from high school and a little bit. I had been to Spain two or three times, but Mexico City looks, Europe looks like a theme park. when you get to Mexico City. And I got a car at the airport, you know, and I started to try and find my hotel. And it took me hours and hours. And I got to Mexico City. It was like the most exciting thing I ever saw. You know, I would go on the subways. Now, I would just get on a subway and go for 10 stops and get up and take pictures. And then I'd go in another place. And I just saw the whole thing. I went like two or three times to Mexico City. Well, 10 times, actually. I made 10 trips to Mexico and Guatemala. And absolutely everyone's been to Mexico to take pictures. And so I made this book called 5 Minutes in Mexico, which was a show that was in here in a couple colleges. But that book was made when there were only 3 trips to Mexico. Now I've got a lot more negatives. So I have a book. I want to extend that book of Mexico. But what this world doesn't need is another book about Mexico. So if you talk to a publisher about it, it's like they, you know, their eyes glass over if you tell them about a book about Mexico.
Really, though? Even the next Mark Cohen book?
Well, you know, I have to... I didn't meet the people that want to do it yet. Let's put it like that. But I'm not, you know, I don't... I'm not like an active pursuer.
It's tough, yeah. You're not out there networking and doggedly.
Here, you know what I mean? This is like... This is a first-class place for invisibility.
Witness relocation.
Yeah, right.
Just to kind of conclude, you live here, you work here. Talk to me a bit about family and how maybe that has impacted what you do, because I would imagine you had the day job, you would go on long walks and chronicle these people in interesting ways, and what kind of support did your support team give you during this time?
Well, they still talk to me. You know, I can probably call all these people and they'll call me back, you know, which is pretty good, because I am not a family guy, you know what I mean? My wife and I are together a long time and she knows it, you know what I mean? And the kids know it, my two sons. And, you know, I'm about pictures and they understand that. And they all supported me. You know what I mean? But I couldn't have kept it going. I mean, without a second job. Lillian had a job as a banker for 15 years, and you know, so they all supported me. You know, but they saw the neurosis. You know, they could see what was happening. You know, and it's firmly implanted now, you know what I mean? It's like, well, I'm not exactly easy, you know. I'm like an artist somehow, and I made these pictures, I made this body of work, and it's in this house here, and I'm about to take them all out. And it's a very ticklish proposition. I've got nice shelves out there, and I got this building that it's like this little. I don't know what to do with these pictures now, and I want to get rid of them, you know, or someplace.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, if people want to learn more about Mark Cohen, his amazing body of work, I would recommend Grimm Street and True Color. Just to definitively conclude this interview, if there's somebody out there that's listening, has an interest in your work, and is maybe thinking of picking up a camera for the very first time here in the digital age, recommendations or pieces of advice, wisdom from the master himself, Mark Cohen.
Well, I never use a digital. I have a digital camera that I use just for inventory purposes. And I look at digital cameras all the time online, but I'm not in New York. I can't actually handle one, you know, but they make them look like, I guess if you get a Leica M9 or something, that's a great digital camera. And the Nikons have to be great. And the Olympus camera they're all terrific cameras. I think they all have like almost instant reaction to your finger pushing the button now. So, but I'm not really sure about it because I haven't done it. And then you make these little nozzle prints. You have to have this great printer, you know, to make great inkjet prints or dye sublimation prints. I don't even know what the language of it is, you know, because we're in a dark room with trays here. I get the chemicals from New York, so I'm still trapped, not trapped, but, you know, I can make a silver print in half an hour, you know, and I don't have to, you know, think about that. I can still get the stuff real easy, you know. They still make Tri-X.
Yeah, I mean, do you recommend that folks have that formal kind of basis and set up a dark room in your basement or in a closet and really put in the kind of labor intensive foundation that you need to be able to get out there and you know, make your own thing.
That might be a nostalgic value now. I mean, I just did this thing in Bethlehem where I was, you know, talking to students individually, and when they, you know, they would come in with show me their picture in a laptop, you know, and they would look at the pictures, and I was really used to always looking at student work. You know, make a portfolio. I used to teach, you know, local schools, and I would always require students to make a portfolio for your final grade, you know, the actual thing.
A hard copy.
A hard copy, yeah. Today everything's a Nook. You know, you get a Kindle or a Nook, and that's, you know, they want to, you know, books are obsolete. And I think they're not quite obsolete, and there's some juncture here that you know, but I don't know. I mean, Amazon sells these books. There's no other way to get them. You know what I mean? It's like you get them in one day. So I don't know what a young person would do if, you know, because by the time this interview's over, you know, they'll have 10 megapixel phones.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
It's like, so I don't know where it's coming. I mean, they've already got shows of guys that make pictures with their phones and then blow them up 6 feet tall. You know, it's like it's Wild West in New York City. You know, it's, you know, to actually take a picture and, you know, like, where's William Klein and Robert Frank? And, exactly. And you know, that is that over now? I guess that's over.
And you notice I'm not schlepping a Nagra out of here. It's this little.
Yeah, I don't think it'll even work.
Well, Mr. Cohen, I really do want to thank you. Making the trip to Wilkes-Barre has been nothing but a pleasure. And thank you so much for opening your home and your studio to Pussyfoot. And the work is amazing, and it's just great to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.